Ave listeners, a quick notice before we get started. For those who support Emperors of Rome on Patreon, there's a new bonus episode with Rhiannon Evans on panegyrics. In particular, the earliest we have, written by Pliny the Younger in honour of the Emperor Trajan. There will be a clip of this at the end of this episode. If you'd like to hear it in full, consider giving your support to Emperors of Rome on Patreon and keep this podcast going. Thanks.
Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome. I'm your host Matt Smith, and with me today is Professor Caelan Davenport, Head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University. This is episode CCLIII, How the Tetrarchy Won the East. With the Tetrarch system still taking shape, Diocletian and his Caesar Galerius come under growing pressure in the East, facing rebellion in Egypt and invasion from the Persian king Naresh. A series of hard campaigns, careful political choices, and eventual victory will determine whether this new imperial order can truly secure Rome's frontiers. Here's Caelan Davenport.
You might remember that back on the 1st of March 293, Diocletian and Maximian proclaimed two Caesars, or junior emperors, to help them with running the empire. Constantius, proclaimed at Milan, was based in the west with Maximian, and we've heard all about the role he played in the reconquest of Britain, which had been under the control of Carausius and Electus. So today we're going to turn to the east and look at Galerius, who is Diocletian's Caesar. Just like Constantius, he was a former army officer, rose up through the ranks, and he was from the Balkan region, just like the other tetrarchs as well. So we're really seeing this military band of brothers now ruling the empire between them.
And it really does seem to be that because there are so many challenges to the empire, to the borders, that these Caesars are being appointed specifically with the mandate of you deal with that problem and here is the authority that you need to do it. So Constantine over in the far west with Britain, but Galerius is given what area to look after or what problem to deal with.
So he is based in the east with Diocletian. He's not given a specific region. He's almost like a roving troubleshooter, at least in the early years. So he's sent pretty swiftly, actually, in 293 to Egypt. And this isn't a foreign invasion, but it's actually an internal revolt that takes place in Upper Egypt. But if you're remembering your Egyptian geography, Upper Egypt is actually South Egypt. I think that's important to get right. The region known as the Bayad around Thebes.
Just to clarify, Upper Egypt, that's because of a terrain height. Southern Egypt, where the origins of the Nile are towards that way, all flows downhill towards the Mediterranean.
That's exactly right. I mean, the Nile Delta, yes, is lower. It's interesting this is happening in Egypt, this revolt. We don't know too much about it. We have two cities that are mentioned, Boresus and Coptus. Coptus in particular is a major trading location, a major trading hub because of the roads that lead there to ports on the Red Sea. And of course, then we get trade across the Indian Ocean coming from there. We don't know what sparked the revolts. We have very little information, but we do know that Galerius was dispatched there very swiftly. He was there by December of 293. We know this from papyri, so our literary source is very terse, but we can get an indication of where the emperor is and the troops that he's brought with him because of papyrus records. Because generally, when the emperor is in town, when he's got the troops, there are requisitions that are made for the army in order to keep them fed and watered, but also to make sure that they've got somewhere to live as well. It seems to be quite a substantial revolt because Galerius was there for over a year. He was there until early 395. And, you know, he was successful in suppressing it. He doesn't take any victory titles at the time. But what is quite interesting is that if we fast forward some years, so about 12 years to 305, when Diocletian retires and Galerius becomes an Augustus, Galerius suddenly acquires two new victory titles, Thebaicus Maximus and Aegyptiacus Maximus. So, you know, the greatest conqueror of the Thebaid and the greatest conqueror of Egypt.
Wow, that's awkward because you don't usually get titles like that awarded when you're dealing with internal problems.
Exactly. And it seems that Diocletian, you know, didn't want him at the time taking those titles. And then suddenly when Diocletian's, you know, retired, he's like, ah, I quite like having these titles that, you know, showed that I played a key role there. And also like the two of them as well, you know, the greatest conqueror of the Thebaid is really specific. So it can only refer to this revolt.
He also named a city after himself.
Oh, yes. So he also named a city after himself, Maximinopolis. This is now the modern city of Kenna in Upper Egypt on the east bank of the Nile. And this is because his full name is Gaius Galerius Valerius Maximianus. So you will see in literary sources, particularly Lactantius, he refers to both the elder Maximian as Maximian, as well as Galerius as Maximian, which, you know, causes great problems for all historians and students.
So at this point, Galerius dusts his hands off and heads back to the east, but that's not the end of the discontent in Egypt, is it? It's the end of the immediate problem, but there's still a lot going on under the surface there.
Yeah, there's real problems a few years later. So in July or August of 297, a man named Lucius Domitius Domitianus declares himself Augustus. And this is really interesting because no literary source mentions Domitius Domitianus by name, but his name does appear on coins, on papyri, and ostraca, sherds of pottery, that are often used for communicating messages, bookkeeping, record keeping in Egypt. So we have dates with Domitianus's regnal year on them. But the ancient literary sources emphasize a man named Aurelius Achilleus, who has the title of Corrector. And this is an administrative official who's often sent in to look after specific cities or specific regions in times of taxation reform or the need to try and look after their finances. They're literally sent in to correct abuses. And because the literary sources are so poor, we don't have much idea of the motivation for the revolt. So I should say that when we've looked at Maximian and Constantius in the West, we've had all these wonderful panegyrics, which have, you know, provided, of course, biased interpretations of events, but have provided a lot of details. But we don't have the equivalent extant from the East. So they would have been delivered in honor of Diocletian and Galerius, but they don't survive. And so we are very much dependent on short, often, you know, one sentence descriptions in Eutropius or Jerome or other literary sources, as well as, of course, the documentary evidence like coins, inscriptions, papyri. But there's a couple of reasons that we could perhaps, you know, suggest why the revolt broke out at this time. A new tax reform was instituted early that year. The prefect of Egypt set out an edict in which he communicated imperial orders that henceforth there was to be more regular cycles of assessment of everyone's property called an indiction, an indiction cycle that was to happen every 5 years. And this is part of Diocletian's efforts to tax the provinces more accurately. And Lactantius complains about this. He complains about the provinces being sliced and diced into even smaller morsels, and each morsel has, you know, their own sort of rank of officials there who are, you know, really getting down at the local level there. That's one possibility. Another issue is that because there's a Persian war going on at the same time, Egypt is very close by. It was like the breadbasket of the empire. So a lot of heavy requisitions to support the army are going to fall on Egypt, you know, for food and supplies. So that might be another reason why revolt is taking place at this time in Egypt.
Yeah, it makes sense. Especially during the 3rd century, there is so much going on around the empire and so much to distract the emperor, even when there is four of them, that it almost seems like Egypt would be doing itself a disservice if it didn't get a bit grumbly about things. Grumbly is underselling it, but, you know.
You're exactly right. Often, you know, we think of Diocletian, you know, he ruled for 20 years, more than 20 years. You know, he's a big success story, founded the Tetrarchy, in inverted commas. But, you know, in the early part of his reign, it could have gone very badly. He could have ended up like other third century emperors. You know, I made the same point in the context of Carausius. And I think we need to take these Egyptian revolts as part of that same phenomenon, is that, you know, they don't know Diocletian is going to hang on, you know, for another sort of 15 years or so, but he is susceptible. And I think that is something that's really important, especially in the context of other third century issues with Egypt. You know, they were under the control of Firmus and Quietus after the murder of Valerian. You know, they were part of Zenobia's empire for a while as well. So they've experienced these upheavals. And, you know, when they're not getting what they want, why not declare their own emperor that's going to look out for them?
So how does this progress then? It isn't something that lasts very long, is it?
No. So 297, 298. But Diocletian actually goes there himself. So he actually leaves the Persian frontier to travel to Egypt. And most of the province is recaptured fairly quickly once he brings his army, except for Alexandria, which holds out until March 298. And there is a sort of a memory we get in the ancient sources of, you know, really harsh reprisals throughout all of Egypt. Eutropius talks about that.
Mm.
There's a good story that Diocletian wouldn't be satisfied with the suppression of Alexandria until the blood of its citizens came up to the knees of his horses. And then as he was riding into Alexandria, his horse stumbled, fell to its knee, and so then he let them off. The knee was on the ground.
I like how you call that a good story. We'll lay off the massacre.
Yes, we'll lay off the massacre. Yes, well, you know, happy ending for all there. But, you know, there does seem to be, you know, a commemoration of Diocletian's victory. There's a massive column, almost 30 meters high, it's erected in Diocletian's honor in the Serapeum in Alexandria. It's erected by the governor. And Diocletian is described as the guardian god of Alexandria in the inscription. It's commonly known, mistakenly, as Pompey's Pillar, based on a misreading of the Greek inscription, which referred to a governor whose name was Publius. The pi has been misread. And of course, you know, Pompey, you know, was killed coming ashore in Egypt.
Yes, so they've gone for the more famous one, but that still stands, doesn't it?
Yes, it still stands today, so you can see that. And it was probably topped with a porphyry statue of Diocletian. Porphyry, red porphyry. This is mined in Egypt. And the statue doesn't survive today, but there was about fragments of a 7-meter porphyry statue found nearby. Mm. But, you know, this porphyry, which comes from Egypt, is almost synonymous with the Tetrarchs in many ways, because, you know, we have the Tetrarchs in Venice and Rome. And, you know, we have heads of Galerius from Gamzigrad, which we'll talk about in another episode, all made out of porphyry. Mm. So, you know, having control of Egypt, control of the trade from the Red Sea, from the quarries, the mines, is really important to the emperors.
So Egypt is now a recurring problem child. So how does Diocletian deal with this problem? He doesn't want to be back there every year or so putting down another revolt.
No. So he actually divides Egypt formally into two provinces, Upper and Lower Egypt. Lower Egypt is called Egypt, but then Upper Egypt is formally called the Thebaid. So each with its own governor and each with its own governor's staff. So people just to keep an eye on everything. He also takes away Alexandria's ability to mint its own coinage. So Alexandria is the last holdout of what we call the system of civic or provincial coinage, where cities in the East were given the right by emperors to design coins themselves. Alexandria has that taken away, and it mints exactly the same coinage as the other imperial mints throughout the empire as well. Mm. So it's definitely a downgrade.
Yeah, but if you don't have the ability to mint, then you can't put your own emperor on a coin all of a sudden.
You're exactly right. There's less of that sort of sense of civic autonomy in Alexandria. There it's, you know, being subsumed under this wider imperial network.
And he strengthens the borders and then he's back off east.
Yes. So he does like a tour through Egypt, making his presence known. Imperial presence is so important in the third century. They like to see emperors there protecting them or reminding them of their military power. So he concludes peace treaties with the southern tribes of the Nabatai and the Blemmyes, and actually gives up a little bit of territory at the bottom of Egypt, establishing the Roman border at Philae, which is an island just north of the main Aswan Dam today. So that's heavily fortified. Mm. It's really interesting to look at the impact of Diocletian on Egypt. There's a scroll of papyri from a place called Panopolis, is now in the Chester Beatty collection. And it provides an indication of all the preparations that have to be made for an imperial visit. The emperor's coming, you know, we need all these horses, we need this much food, exactly, and who's going to provide them, and where is it going to come from, and it's not arrived on time, and, you know, lots of slightly passive-aggressive papyri being sent back and forth in the administration there. So, you know, I think if you get those sort of, you know, snarky emails from colleagues at work that you haven't done something in time, you know, they were still doing it back in third century Egypt as well.
So this has been a major distraction, I think, more than anything. I mean, it was something that Diocletian needed to deal with, and he clearly thought that he needed to deal with it himself. But the real threat for Diocletian's reign, I guess, is from Persia. And it has always been from that direction, more or less, I think, for the past few hundred years for Rome. So what is happening over in the East now?
Yes, exactly right. So Persia is the main conflict. And since coming to power, Diocletian had the upper hand. And I think this is really due to Carus, actually, who penetrated all the way through to Ctesiphon, the capital, shortly before he died, you know, when his tent was struck by lightning. And so, you know, Carus really struck a blow there. And so Diocletian was dealing with a relatively chastened Shahanshah, the King of Kings, Bahram II. And actually, they concluded an agreement where Armenia, which has long been like a ping pong ball between the two empires, it has been under Persian control. And they reached an agreement essentially to divide it in two so that the eastern part would remain under Persian command, but the western would be under the command of a client king, a vassal king, picked by Diocletian. This was Tiridates, either the third or the fourth, depending on the chronology. So, you know, Diocletian, really because of Carus's successes there, is able to force this sort of diplomatic triumph and really recreate at least part of Armenia as a buffer state between Rome and Persia. However, there was a change in 293 when Bahram II died. He was succeeded by his son, Bahram III, who was only a child. And there was considerable discontent, actually, amongst the Persian nobility. And Bahram III was actually deposed by his great uncle Narsi. Narsi is a son of Shapur I as well. Shapur I, you know, he's the guy that captured Valerian back in 250.
Gave Persia some of their greatest victories in years.
That's exactly, exactly right. And, you know, we have those wonderful triumphal monuments, you know, with Valerian being crushed. Narsi was the younger son, and so the line had not passed to him. And he mainly spent most of his time governing outer territories of the Sasanian Persian Empire, including Armenia. So he is actually based in Armenia when Bahram II dies. He's ruling what is left of the Persian provinces. We have an inscription, actually, which gives Narses' view of events. It's the Pakuli inscription, which is found in northeastern Iraq. And it's fragmentary, but it provides justification for Narsi's sort of takeover and dethronement of his great nephew. He says the nobles appealed to him to come from Armenia to take control. And then he lists like all the supporters that he has, most of whom come from the outer regions of the empire. So it seems during his long career as a governor, he built up this sort of network of supporters. Peter Edwell talks about this in his book on Rome and Persia at War. And at the end, the inscription says that he made peace with Diocletian. Caesar and the Romans were in gratitude and peace and friendship with us. So Diocletian accepted the takeover by Narsi.
So what does Armenia think of being caught in the middle of all of this?
Yeah, it doesn't seem to go well. They don't seem to stick to the script where they're just supposed to be a nice buffer state. And Tiridates, you know, starts to show aggression towards the Persians. We're not quite sure how, but certainly as skirmishes into their territory. And Narsi responded, invading both Armenia and then Roman territory in Osrhoene in 296. And of course, you know, this is the resumption of hostilities. Caesar and the Romans are no longer in peace and friendship. But Diocletian's not there. Diocletian's in the Balkans. He's campaigning against the Carpi there on the Danube. But, you know, this is why we have a Caesar. Galerius is there. You know, he's come back to the region after that first revolt in Egypt. But he's soundly defeated by Narsi in battle somewhere between Carrhae, that's Haran in Turkey, and Callinicum, Raqqa in Syria. Now, it seems that Galerius didn't actually have much time to get a big force together in order to tackle Narsi. Eutropius, you know, emphasizes that he contended with a small army against a very numerous enemy. That's Eutropius 9:24. So it seems that rather than waiting for reinforcements, he took to the battlefield with what he had and was defeated.
So this is the second time then in this episode that Galerius has dealt with a problem inadequately.
Yes, I suppose. Yes, I mean, he did put down the revolt in Egypt, but then it flared up a few years later. Yes, I mean, there's a story that Diocletian is not happy with Galerius, that when Diocletian makes his way to the Eastern Front, that Diocletian makes him either run by his chariot or walk in front of his chariot. So I'll just give you a couple of different versions of this story. So Eutropius 9:24 says, being in consequence defeated and going to join Diocletian, he was received by him when he met him on the road with such extreme haughtiness that he is said to have run by his chariot for several miles in his scarlet robes. So, you know, in his imperial regalia, he was made to rubbish, and it must have been quite heavy as well. And Ammianus uses this anecdote to illustrate, you know, the grip that Diocletian and Maximian, or specifically Diocletian, had on the Imperial College. Ammianus 14:11-10 says that, you know, Diocletian and his colleague were obeyed by their Caesars as if, you know, by attendants, who did not remain in one place, but hastened about hither and thither, and that in Syria, Galerius, clad in purple, walked for nearly a mile before the chariot of his Augustus when the latter was angry with him.
Yeah, wow.
And this lasts all the way to the 9th century. It's repeated again and again in Byzantine sources, all the way up to Theophanes.
You can't just leave it there. You've got a big, long quote there from Theophanes.
Yes, yes. So Theophanes says, AM 5793, Maximianus Galerius was sent out by Diocletian against the Persian Empire Narses, who at that time overrun Syria and was plundering it. In the first battle after they met, near Clinicon and Carrhae, Galerius was defeated. On returning in flight, he met Diocletian travelling in a carriage. However, Diocletian did not receive the Caesar in a manner appropriate to his rank, but made him run a considerable distance in front of the carriage.
I want that to be true.
It's a great story,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Particularly, you know, running in your regalia. You have to retain the insignia to show how much you have disgraced it.
And it's very humiliating in front of the troops, and the locals get a good laugh out of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, obviously it started from somewhere. There must have been some event that, you know, even if it was misinterpreted, that indicated that Diocletian was not happy with Galerius. Now, Bill Ledbetter, who has written a biography of Galerius, you know, and as biographers do tend to defend their subjects, he has said that, you know, whatever the outcome, Galerius did stop Narsi advancing further into Roman territory. That is true, for whatever reason, despite, you know, defeating Galerius, Narses didn't go any further. But, you know, clearly Diocletian didn't see it that
way.
Can
I also maybe defend Galerius just a little bit and say that is stories like this, or, you know, tales of his inadequacies in battle or those sort of things, a reflection of how pro-Constantine the history records are?
Yeah, I mean, Galerius definitely, everyone loves to poke Galerius, you know, because he's one of the persecuting tetrarchs. Definitely, you know, it's rare to find any sources that say something nice about him. And I'm sure Christian writers rejoiced telling that story over and over again, particularly in the Byzantine period. I mean, Ammianus isn't a Christian, but certainly, you know, the Byzantine writers like Theophanes are. And, you know, they would definitely want to make sure that humiliation was on record. Mm.
So at this point, we'll just slightly interrupt things to point out that this is the time when Diocletian heads back to Egypt to deal with the revolt that we talked about earlier, which leaves Galerius in the east, doesn't it?
Yeah, so it shows that Diocletian must have trusted him to some measure because, you know, Diocletian's going off to Egypt. He didn't choose to send Galerius to Egypt. But as you said, maybe that's because he didn't put down the revolt properly the first time. But certainly Persia's the bigger enemy. But yeah, Diocletian goes off to deal with the revolt of Domitianus and Achilleus. But we know that Galerius has more troops now because we know that there's vexillations, detachment of troops that come from the Danube to augment his army, possibly about 25,000 total. And Galerius uses this opportunity to go on the offensive. So he tries to redeem himself and does so very successfully. So he actually surprises Narses and the Persians at Satala in Cappadocia. There are stories of, you know, that he has Armenian spies in the camp, or even, you know, one case that, you know, Galerius manages to reconnoiter their camp himself. But it pays off. You know, it's a major victory. And Galerius manages to capture the Persian train, the court, including their treasury, Narses' children and wives. Narses himself escapes. But, you know, the Romans now have his wives and children.
Wow.
As well.
That's a big bargaining chip to have, really.
Definitely. And Galerius is not humble about it. So later on in his career, he erects, you know, a massive arch at Thessaloniki, where he's based in the 4th century. And we have a Wed in Rome episode on the whole arch. So
we do.
You can listen to that. But, you know, we know more about the campaign thanks to the arch. You know, we can see the emperor addressing his troops in front of Satala, you know, the Persian train surrendering. But it also contains idealized scenes. You know, there's this scene of single combat between Galerius and Narses, where they're both on horses that, you know, are rearing up, you know, looking very much like Alexander the Great, you know, as they fight off in single combat, which didn't happen. But, you know, it's a way for Galerius to place himself at the center of this victory. After the coup at Satala, you know, he pushes forward. By September of 298, he's recaptured Nisibis, which is in northeastern Syria today, and then, you know, goes all the way down to Ctesiphon, just like Carus had done. And we know, little detail, that Constantine, a young Constantine, was almost certainly serving in his army at the time. So Constantine's the son of the Western Caesar Constantius, but we know in a speech, the oration to the Assembly of the Saints delivered in 325, Constantine says that he has personally seen the ruins of Babylon. And as Timothy Barnes pointed out, this is the only occasion in which a Roman army was there at a time Constantine would be old enough to serve in it. And so that's a little suggestive detail about Constantine's later life, that, you know, at this time he is very much embedded in the Tetrarchic army corps.
Yeah. Oh, that's a cool little detail.
If we never had that speech, we wouldn't know, but so thankfully we do.
Yeah. So this brings an end to the conflict for now, doesn't it? Very decisive victory, it seems, for the Romans.
Definitely. Yes, they actually now formally conclude a peace treaty, which hadn't actually been done after Carus's victory. So it's important to get that all signed off. So they met at Nisibis in early 299. Diocletian is back in town after his success in Egypt. But it seems the main negotiations were actually overseen by an official, Sicorius Probus, who has the title of Magister Memoriae, or Master of the Memory. And this is one of those officials, we don't actually quite know what they did. He seems to have actually been involved in edicts and pronouncements. He actually travels into the Persian heartland to pronounce Diocletian's terms to Narsi. And we know this thanks to an excerpt from a 6th century author called Peter the Patrician. And he doesn't survive in full, but we have fragments. And he does certainly depend on earlier 3rd or 4th century sources. So we know from this account that Sicorius Probus is sent to Media in the Persian heartland. And you know, he said with very clear message, you know, Sicorius Probus says the River Tigris must be the boundary between Rome and Persia. Armenian territory is going to be extended, so the territory of that kingdom, right up to the Median border. Romans would also get to choose not only the client king of Armenia, so obviously Tiridates is still in place, but also Iberia, which is in the Caucasus, so not Spain and Portugal, it's another kingdom there. And also the treaty was to specify that Nisibis is to be like the one place where there's to be, you know, commercial transactions between Rome and Persia. Mm. That's really important to the Romans because it means, you know, they can capture the tax on trade. So for them to have this one depot is really important. And Narsi apparently didn't like the provision about Nisibis. We don't know why, but he objected to that, maybe because he didn't want the trade being monitored in that way. But Probus replies, nope, I've got no way to negotiate. Diocletian has given me no room to maneuver. This is what you have to agree to. And Narsi backs down because the Romans are holding the women and children of his family. And so that's the bargaining chip. And the treaty is signed.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds like Narsi didn't have a choice in it at all.
Not at all.
And can I just say very tangentially that I really like the term Magister Memoriae.
Yes.
What did you say it translated into?
Just Master of the Memory.
That sounds like a really cool medieval, almost a Dungeons and Dragons version of a historian, a Master of the Memory.
Yes, that's right. Like, they're the keeper of all the records.
I want to see that on your door next time I go up and visit you, Kaelin.
Excellent. Yes. No, I will give myself that title. It's even more mysterious because we don't know exactly what they did. It's almost like, you know, perhaps if they're in charge of edicts and pronouncements that, you know, these are things that are going to be remembered, perhaps by the other population. No, we really don't know. And it's this position that sort of comes into existence only at this point in the 3rd century. They have assistants. There's the assistant of the memory as well, which is recorded in papyri.
We will help you remember.
Yes, exactly. They don't do it all themselves.
Yeah, now they call that PAs. A great victory then for Diocletian, for Galerius and the Tetrarchy at a whole then.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a wonderful triumph in Antioch the following year, 300. We're told that Diocletian was in the chariot while Galerius has to walk alongside him.
Not as a punishment this time, though.
No. Bill Laird better said it's a place of honour. And, you know, so it should be because, you know, Galerius does manage to turn things around. And we see, you know, from his arch in Thessaloniki that it does become his crowning achievement in many ways. It's his contribution to the Tetrarchic rule. Constantius, you know, the Western Caesar has had his moment to shine, and now Galerius has his. So things are very much looking up for the Tetrarchs. Mm.
And so we leave this episode in the year 300 with the Roman Empire in a good place.
Yeah, the Tetrarchy was in a really good place. Carausius had been defeated, the revolts in Egypt had been suppressed, and there was now peace with Persia.
That was Professor Kaelin Davenport, head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. We are a listener-supported podcast, so thanks to everyone helping us out on Patreon. A new exclusive episode has just gone online with Rhiannon Evans discussing panegyrics. Here's a bonus clip.
This is a speech presented in the year 100 when Pliny was consul. Trajan gets praised to the skies, but of course this is good for Pliny too, big public occasion for him. Mm. I mean, he has reached the top of the tree to be consul, but this is going to promote his career, and indeed very soon he will be proconsul in Bithynia, and we've got a lot of letters to and fro. Pliny did well out of this, I think, but it is very influential clearly on those later panegyrics. And we can still see these traits in those later panegyrics. We know others existed, but we don't have anything other than mentions of them. But we have this whole speech.
To hear the entire episode, go to patreon.com/Rome podcast. This podcast is recorded and produced in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.